This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila.
And we are Spy Fat Chicks.
We're eating right now.
Which is actually something we don't usually do in the podcast. Usually we do it after we eat. But today we went and saw Julie and Julia.
Woo! The much anticipated episode of the movie and the book that we've only been talking about on Facebook for the past month.
And we were going to go to a restaurant afterwards, but we felt a French picnic was in order. So we went and got some bread, some cheeses, a little bit of ham, and we're having a picnic by the lake.
Mm-hmm. And I also think this will give Sheila a chance to talk, because if my mouth's full and I'm eating, I'm not talking, so she can jump in for a change. So we're going to try this technique out.
That brie's really good.
Yeah. Actually, in case you're curious, we stopped at Country Produce, and we got a whole wheat baguette, French baguette, a little wedge of brie, a chunk of smoked Gouda, and some wine-soaked, semi-soft goat cheese. And it's delicious. And Sheila got some olives and two bottles of Diet Stewart's root beer. Good stuff. The root beer's not French.
We're gonna go for wine, but open container laws and all.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's probably for the best that we didn't. But first, we just want to, one, put a huge spoiler alert on this whole episode. If you haven't read the book or watched the movie and you don't want to know anything about it beyond the fact it's about French cooking and Julia Child and this blogger, Julie Powell, stop now. Go listen to another episode. I recommend the sushi episode or the dim sum episode or something else. Don't listen to this. That being said, if we spoil the movie for you, it's your own fault because you kept listening. You had your chance to stop. We're not doing a review of the movie as a movie critic. We're not going to talk about the photography or the costumes or anything like that. We're not going to talk about the book in a literary sense. We're going to talk about the food and about French cooking and how at least this changed my opinions of French cooking in a way.
We're going to talk about the ideas behind it, more like the spirit of French cooking, if you will,
mm-hmm.
rather than the actual interpretations of it.
Mm-hmm. So,
but the movie was really good and enjoyable, and the book is a really good read, and you should check out Julie Powell's blog.
It's still
up. The Julie and Julia Project is still up.
Yeah, the blog is still up. The original blog is still there. Just put Julie and Julia into Google, and it'll pop up. I've read about a quarter of the blog so far. We've both read the book. We've both seen the movie. I've been paging through Mastering the Art of French Cooking this past week just for fun.
For feces and ha-has.
For feces and ha-has. And it's... I don't even know how to approach this because I had a very negative opinion of French cooking because in my mind, I always associated it with what Sheila calls hot cuisine. Spelled H-A-U-T-E.
Haute cuisine.
Not hot cuisine. Oh, it's too hot to eat. No, I like spicy food. That's not... No. I have always associated it with...
The pretentious. Way too artistic.
Here's your squiggle of sauce with this weird sculpture of food on your plate that is barely a serving. And it's not...
And you don't even know how to eat it.
Yeah, and it's not that I don't like it because there's not enough food. By all means, I am all for eating just a little bit of something for the taste of it. I mean, that's the whole point of sushi. You know, you get these little tastes of things, and I love that. But I've always associated the hoity-toity... doing something different, even though it may taste like for the sake of doing it. I've always associated that with French cooking, so I've had a very negative experience. Plus, when I was in France when I was 15, I had a 15-year-old palate, didn't really know any of the language, didn't know what I was eating, and I was very leery of everything was being served. Because everybody told us, oh, they're going to serve you horse while you're over there. And I was like, I don't want to eat horse. Now I actually want to try horse. God forbid.
Sorry, horse lovers.
Yeah, I do want to try horse at some point. But I feel that set a negative tone for me, too. I never realized that most French cuisine, real French cuisine, is the simple good stuff.
Yeah, and here I'm going to go on a philosophical tangent. The way I approach food is like art. It can definitely be an expression, and here's where you have the different interpretations. The haute cuisine, that's like modern art, and a lot of people don't get it, and I'm not going to rain on anybody's parade and say that you shouldn't be creating it and there's no place in this world for it. By all means, that's your expression. That's fine. However, not everybody is going to get it. People do get Robert Bateman, who does a bunch of wildlife art. People do get a lot of the Impressionist painters who did landscape scenes and put feeling into them. It's still an expression, but it's a more accessible expression.
Hmm. That goat cheese is really good, too. Just thought I'd throw that out. It's almost a little bit sweet.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and that's... It's not that I'll say I'll never get haute cuisine. Maybe someday I'll understand it. I never really had any of it. And to me, there's a fine line between doing something new and innovative and doing crap for the sake of crap. It's like the people
pretension.
You throw paint on a canvas. It's the same thing. Me, I like food that tastes good and is nourishing. And if it looks funky, I don't care. I'm going to eat it. I have to admit also, all the sauces in French cooking make me a little bit nervous because I'm not a mayonnaise fan. But we also know I've never had real mayonnaise. I've only ever had the really gross stuff in the jar that tastes like oil. And we should make real mayonnaise sometime and see if I like it.
I've made it before in school, and it tastes way different.
You see, and I probably like that. Doesn't it have a faint mustardy taste, too?
Yeah, it tastes more like a cream sauce than it does taste like oil.
So, with that being said, the book and the movie combined, I don't even know how to talk about them separately. I guess we should just touch on what's different from the book to the movie, and then we'll talk about them together. Does that sound okay?
That sounds good. And that goat cheese is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, to begin with, I thought we were going to have to rate this podcast as being a neutral rating rather than clean, because the book is rather risque. It would probably be, if it was made into a movie just straight off, it would probably be rated R for language and adult situations. However, the movie...
Julie Powell likes the F word a lot.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Which is fine. We like the F word, too. Yeah. We just try not to use it in this podcast primarily because...
We want to make it accessible.
We'll make it accessible. Selfishly, I'd like my niece to be able to hear it. If my sister would ever listen to the podcast, go dig, dig. But, you know, I'd like for, you know, people to put it on in the car if they have their kids in the car and they're not going to worry about what we're saying. But, yeah, Julie Powell's blog, she uses the F word a lot. In the book, there's a lot of risque stuff. The movie was not risque at all. The book... She has interspersed in between the chapters these... They're dramatized. She admits they're dramatized. Little sections about letters of Paul, Julia's husband, talking about her. And it's based on real letters that she read. And you don't get the depth to Julia Child you get in the movie because the movie's really two books. It's Julie Powell's book about doing the recipes. And it's also based on Julia Child's memoirs. Her, what's it called? My Life in France?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And instead of using Julie Powell's flavor... chapters where she dramatizes things that happen in letters, they end up using Julia Child's book, so they get a more,
they get more depth,
a more deep view of what's going on in Julia Child and Paul Child's lives.
And that really made the movie to me.
Yeah. That definitely, I mean, that was a huge, I was really glad that they did it that way.
And I loved how they approached Julia Child as a person. I liked how they added personality to her. Not that that woman needed much more personality. We've done our homework this week. We have been reading about her. We have watched some of her old shows. And there was this awesome scene in the movie where they had a Meryl Streep as Julia Child reenacting one of her old shows. It was the one with the potatoes, one of the first ones. And it was where she goes to flip the potato pancake and it falls all over the stove. And we had just watched that episode this past week.
And you could tell that Julia Child was, when you see the original episode, she was kind of nervous. You know, it's her first time being on TV, and she's dreadfully afraid of dead air, and she goes ahead and she's like, okay, well, if I have the courage to do this, it'll work just fine, and she flips it and like half of it falls onto the stove, and they did it exactly in the movie, exactly how we saw it on DVD.
She even says this thing, you're all by yourself in the kitchen, just put it back in and nobody will know, or something like that.
Who
Who will see? It was great. I even blogged about that. I even put that on Facebook when we were watching that episode. I'm like, she's crazy. Julia Child, somebody commented, Julia Child believes in the 5-second rule. Who knew? But yeah, all over the stove, she just throws it back in.
Who will see?
So, I mean, I want to read her memoir next.
Yes.
But I'm really impressed with how they approached her in the movie. And that was something you didn't get from Julie Powell's book because it was not about that. It was about the trials of cooking 500-some French recipes in 1 year while having a full-time job in the middle of New York.
Yes.
So that was one other difference. They cut out some characters. They combined some characters. You didn't get quite the depth into Julie Powell's life that you get in the book, obviously. They didn't really focus on her life working for the government as much. Get a lot more detail in the book.
Yeah, in the book, she was working for a government agency who was trying to put up the memorial where the Twin Towers stood after 9/11. And that must have been a really punishing job.
I couldn't do it.
I wouldn't have been able to handle it.
I couldn't do it. But nonetheless, she's doing this while trying to cook all these recipes, and she's turning 30, which is traumatic for some people. I had no twinges when I turned 30 last year, but I also have come to accept the fact that because our lifespans have gotten extended so far, that 30 is not really 30 anymore. 30 is like the new 25. I'm okay with that. I'll freak when I turn 35. No, I'm kidding. But that was something you didn't get quite the flavor of in the movie. This whole one of the scenes that they keep putting in all the previews that didn't occur anywhere in the book was the luncheon, the Cobb salad luncheon or something.
Yeah.
That was something they just
threw made her
in.
Friends into kind of, like, I know that you have to have a certain attitude to live in New York, but they made her friends super New York, which is not how they were in the book.
Well, they needed motivation because her motivation in the book was totally different. Her motivation in the book for the whole project was because...
just to do it.
No, she was turning 30, and she had gone to the doctor, and the doctor had scared her and said, if you don't get pregnant now, you may not, because you have the ovary cyst thing.
Oh, yeah.
And she was freaking out. Her biological clock was ticking, she turned 30, all that good stuff. And they didn't want to put that in the movie, which I think it played for a better movie to do it with the snotty friends at lunch thing, where she's,
right.
instead of freaking out about not having a kid, in the movie she's freaking out because her friends have all done this stuff, and she's really not done much with her life at this point. Which is fine if you don't. I mean, I have done very little with my life in comparison to, you know, famous people, but I'm okay with that.
But she wasn't where she wanted to be,
exactly.
and comparing herself to her friends, she realized that there was a lot more that she wanted to do with her life.
So that's another major difference in the book. But other than that, they really did a good job keeping it fairly close. They cut what they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
So from here on out, we could talk about it, and it's either going to be, if it's only about Julia Child, it's just going to be from the movie. If it's about Julie Powell, it's from the book and the movie.
Right. And I never expected the movie to be exactly like the book, because they're two different creatures, and I don't expect that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good to kind of... let people know about that. So if they have rather delicate sensibilities, mm-hmm. and they enjoyed the movie, they won't be put off by the book when they pick it up and see F-bombs everywhere.
Yeah. and really, I'm one of those people who's very hard on movies when they're made, first a book. And I was thrilled with how they approached this. Just from a whole movie perspective. I loved it. I want to get a copy when it comes out.
Yeah.
We were so excited about it. We went to see it on opening weekend, which was this weekend. And I'm so excited about it when it comes out on DVD. I want to get it the first week it's out.
Yeah.
Because it's just so cool. So, on to French food in general.
Right.
I've admitted my ignorance.
Well, you have the whole haute cuisine versus peasant food.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it all has to do with perception, doesn't it? I mean, we perceive that the French think that they're better than us, that they have these high-minded mm-hmm. ideals. And in a way, you know...
it's not true.
It's not true. They just... they're just a different culture.
Parisians are a little snotty, but other than that, everybody else is pretty darn cool.
Right, I mean, you've been to France, and you said in the countryside, people are people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just regular folks just like us.
Mm-hmm.
They just happen to have a lot better butter and a lot better cheese, because
mm-hmm.
they don't have the pasteurization laws that we do.
That's another show, but actually... and this episode's going to be bumped to the top of the queue. You're going to see this almost the next day after we finish this. But we're going to record either later today or another day this week another episode that talks about, again, French food from another book. And also covers some of the stuff with the pasteurization laws. In France, they're cracking down. They're losing some of their
heritage.
Their heritage because of it. But that's another show.
Huh. It's called Last Chance to Eat. If you want to pick it up, start flipping through it.
Yeah. Take notes. We'll do a book discussion later now. So, but yeah, it never dawned on me. As many times as I've eaten it, the few times we've made it, something as simple as French onion soup is actually French. I just thought it was called French onion soup. Like, French onion dip is French onion dip, but it's not
right.
really French. No, French person in their mind, right mind, would make that, right? French onion dip with a little packet.
Yeah, it's like, it's French flavored, which is entirely, it's like how buffalo wings have now got... you've got buffalo flavoring.
Yes.
So you have buffalo pizza and buffalo sandwiches,
exactly.
things like that.
Exactly. French onion
flavoring. Referring to the flavorings rather than the actual original dish that it came
from. Yes, but I never, ever realized until we sat down and watched Julia Child's episode on French onion soup. I was like, oh, that is French. And then we made it this week. Which I made it on Friday, actually. No, Saturday. Yeah, I did it yesterday, Saturday.
Yeah.
And it was just... it was one of those things, you have that dawning moment, you're like, oh, okay. And poached eggs, I never realized, featured so prominently in French cooking until I read the book and I heard her nightmares about trying to poach eggs.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a poached egg, but nonetheless, I like eggs, I'd probably love a poached egg. And I love her reaction in the book and the blog and the movie to her eating her first egg. Julie Powell never ate eggs. And when she did the project, she said, I'm going to have to eat an egg.
Like she'd eaten it when it was cooked in something, like a cake or something.
But she didn't sit down and eat like a fried egg or a hard-boiled egg. And her reaction was, it tastes like cheese sauce.
Mm.
And it, you know the texture of a well-cooked egg where it's not all hard, but it's still kind of
it's very
liquid.
Fresh.
Yeah. That's very, very close to that. And I liked that. Because I used to be egg phobic. I used to hate eggs. When I was a kid, I used to only dip out my bacon and sausage in the yolk, and I'd leave the rest of the egg. And I think it was one of the times I came to visit you. We went to the
mm-hmm.
Rainbow, and I said, oh, I like eggs now. Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can relate to that. in the movie and the book, I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe I should expand my horizons and try a few other things that I've never liked before either, like mayonnaise.
Right.
I'm willing to give the homemade stuff a shot.
Yeah, it really is a totally different thing. Now, we talked about, too, how food brings us together, not only cooking for somebody that you love, but eating with people. Food is very intrinsic to, it's much more than just survival for us as animals. We view it as a window to our past. We have recipes that have been handed down generations. We cook dishes that historical reenactors find dishes that were cooked in the period that they're interested in. And that's like our link to the past. It's like finding a long-lost relative that you didn't know and you're very proud of that did great things. Mm-hmm. It's something that keeps people together.
And I approach it in a slightly different vein, but a parallel one. And this is something I think the movie brings together because it's a love story. It is a love story between Julie and her husband and Julia and Paul, her husband. Now, to me, if I really like somebody, and I don't mean like, ooh, you know, junior high like. I mean, if I'm genuinely fond of you, the most valuable gift I can give you is my time. I can't just say, here, have 10 minutes of my time because I'm so special that that's valuable. But more along the lines of, I'm going to make something for you. So I'll sit down and make you a keychain or what have you. Or I'll cook for you because I think highly of you that I'm going to spend my time, which is one thing you never get back. You have a finite amount of time on this planet. Once it's gone, it's gone. So for me to sit down...
And no one knows how much it is.
Yeah. For me to sit down and say, I feel that strongly about you that I want to do something for you that takes an hour out of my life I will never give back. To me, that's a valuable gift. And then let's bring into the whole end of the argument that food is nourishment. Food is life. So if you really feel strongly about somebody, you're going to cook for them. Because not only are you giving them time out of your life you're never going to get back, the most valuable gift you can give, you're giving them sustenance. You're giving them nourishment. And that sums up the whole movie book combo to me. And that sums up why cooking's important. And I don't just mean going out and going to a restaurant. Chefs at a restaurant don't cook for you because they love you. They cook because they want your money. But when your wife sits down and makes a special meal for you, it says something else. When one of your friends brings cupcakes to the office, she says, I like all you guys this much that you can have 1/100th of my time with this cupcake, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that.
And I care enough about you that I brought this for you. I was thinking about you while you weren't around.
Yes.
Which is another thing people like to be thought of. It's like whenever you pick up a gift for a friend to give it to them, even if it's for no occasion at all, you're showing when we're not face to face, I think about you and I care about you.
So now that we've got totally philosophical about why we feel so strongly about this cooking, why we feel so strongly about this movie, this book, in general, I hope you understand it a little bit better, why we wanted to do this episode. So French cooking itself, I do want to talk a little bit about the recipes themselves. Again, I am ignorant of French cooking. This is an ignorance that I've felt more strongly over the past couple weeks than I ever have before, and I genuinely want to try a lot of these recipes. The beef
bourguignon.
I am also ignorant of the French language, so Sheila will say all the recipes properly for me. What is in that?
You braise the beef in the oven with oil and butter. Then you build the fluid of the of the stew and put the vegetables and everything in it. And there's red wine in it, and it's like, I don't know.
It's a glorified stew dish.
Right, it's a baked stew,
and
is what it is.
It sounds so scary, but...
Instead of being made on the stove, it's made in the oven, and it's slow roasted. Well, braised, I guess, is the technical term, since it's a wet method of cooking.
Which, but, by the way, for those who don't know, when you have a cut of meat that's pretty tough, like stew meat, which you would use for beef bourguignon, yeah. I speak German and English, and that's it, and it shows. So, when you have that dish, and you use stew meat for it, the ideal cooking method is a slow braising method, because it keeps the meat moist, it lets all the connective tissue dissolve and fall apart, and leaves the meat tender while leaving the flavor in there, because you cooked it moistly.
Right, and then the connective tissue gives that certain sort of unctuousness, that lip-smacking good,
that deliciousness,
to whatever the fluid is that you're cooking in, whatever liquid you're using.
Yeah, because that connective tissue, it dissolves out and gives body to the liquid, which is one of the reasons there's a difference between a broth and a stock. Which, making French onion soup, I was lazy, I admit it. I didn't want to do my own out of bones, because I just didn't feel like it. So instead I went and I got a couple of cartons of broth, and then I got a couple cans of stock to add the unctuousness, as Sheila puts it, back into it, because you had that almost, it's almost like gelatin. So, remember the last pulled pork roast I made?
Right. Well, it gives you the flavor without the fat. Because the connective tissue has that, it's like gelatin. So it gives you that
Yeah.
It feels like oil, but it's not.
Well, it looks so much like gelatin and acts so much like it. This is hysterical because I knew this. This is the sad part. I knew this. I learned it from watching Alton Brown, and I was an idiot and forgot. We had just made this past week a pulled pork roast, and we do it in an unorthodox way. We don't get a pork shoulder. We get one of the pork loins. I try to get the fattiest pork loin we can find, and we do a rub on it, and then we braise it forever in the oven. And we do like a braising.
Like we're going to do ribs. But
like we do ribs in the oven.
Instead we're using a loin.
And you're supposed to be able to take the liquid, and this is an Alton Brown recipe, you're supposed to be able to take the liquid out of the packet when you're finished and reduce it down to a sauce to put on the ribs. I've never gotten it to work right. I've done this probably, what, 8 times now at minimum the past year, and I cannot get it to work right. And this last time I said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I know part of the reason the sauce isn't thickening is because there's too much fat in it, and when I heat the sauce, the fat stays liquid and it still makes it all thin. So I got smart, drained the liquid, put it in the fridge so I could peel the fat off when it rose to the top and hardened, which I did 2 days later. Mm-hmm. Because I was all excited. I said, I'm going to make the sauce. I'm going to put it aside, and we'll have it the next time we have pulled pork. And when I pulled it out and I pulled the nice disc of pork fat off the top, it looked like meat-flavored Jell-O underneath. Salty meat-flavored Jell-O. And I said, oh, that's disgusting. I'm sure this isn't good for us. And I rinsed it down the drain. Then I told Sheila about it a day later.
Why did you do that?
I don't know.
Threw away all the unctuousness down the drain.
You threw the flavor away, I think is what you said. Because I wasn't thinking. And again, just one of those moments, something comes out of the fridge you weren't expecting to look like Jell-O.
So, French cooking. Well,
it's all about the sauce.
Yeah, and what grows together goes together is an excellent philosophy. In France, they have lots of pastoral land where in, like, for example, Greece or Italy, mm-hmm. it's more rocky, more mountainy. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of milk out of milk. You get lots of butter, lots of cream, lots of cheese. And that's why French cooking is the way it is. Mm-hmm. They have room and the space to put cows. So they do. Mm-hmm.
And whereas, that makes sense where because the dairy is so readily available, it features so prominently in their cooking. And it also makes sense why cream and butter are a big deal in British cooking. Because British beef was the thing for how long?
Yeah.
I mean, centuries. British beef was it.
There's, so. Like, poems written about cattle raids and things like mm-hmm. that in Celtic culture. So
that makes sense why, especially in those two cultures, that you see cream and butter so prominently figured. But to get a historical note, French cooking, like we think of it, with all the crazy recipe tweaks, didn't come around until the last Louis?
14th.
The 14th, not the last Louis. And because he had these people in his court, he was the egg guy, wasn't he? He was all about eggs.
He was all about everything. And they did, like, crazy things to amuse the senses as well as the palate. Where they'd have, you know, it's almost like a throwback to medieval
subtleties.
Subtleties.
Is what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Where they'd have, like something.
Where they'd pluck the peacock, gut it, cook it, and then put the feathers back on and at the table so it looked like it was a peacock sitting there on the table.
And it's all about presentation in that case. And French food is a lot about presentation. Asian food is a lot about presentation, but I don't think it's as well known.
Yeah.
You think of a fancy presentation, your first thing that should pop to mind if you're kind of a foodie is French food. Though Chinese cooking is court cooking, because they had the same thing going on in China with court cooking.
Right, we had
they
the emperor.
They had these insane banquets that just almost blew French banquets out of the water. They were just so insane. They did the same thing. And even when I was in China, you know, a lot of the food, the presentation was prominent. The hotel I stayed at, they had that huge, it was like a convention where they had subtleties out for display, where they did artwork with the vegetables and fruit. I don't know the word for it. But they had these
like
just fantastic
garnishes. That looked like flowers and things like that.
They had like castles out of it and dragons, just gorgeous stuff. So it's something you see all across the culinary world. But again, French cooking.
We're talking about French cooking right
now. That's where most of it. The Western world really gets it from.
Right.
But modern French cooking, if I have to blame anything for, not the negative viewpoint of French cooking.
You could say the negative connotations.
Yeah, the negative connotations of all that snobby is that stupid Michelin rating thing. And that's where a restaurant gets 1, 2, or 3 stars, and a restaurant can have no stars. And the Michelin guide is supposed to be this awesome restaurant guidebook that tells you what restaurants are good and which ones aren't. But it reminds me of Ratatouille, the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 star deal.
Exactly.
It's like that.
Well, you have these two opposing forces where you have the populist notion, mm-hmm. the food is for the people, and anybody can cook if they really want to put... You may have a talent for something, but if you put enough hard work in, you can do whatever you want. And if you devote yourself to something like French cooking, even if you don't have a lot of talent for it, you will be 10 times further ahead than somebody who has a lot of talent and doesn't practice it.
Yes.
And doesn't do it, doesn't cook over and over again.
Which is at the heart and soul of Ratatouille. But
yes.
You get to that concept of, I'm going to cater to impress a restaurant critic to get my next star in my restaurant. And that is, I think, where the negative connotation for French cuisine comes from.
Because
people don't think of a hearty cream and egg dish that's very filling, kind of bad for you.
Well, if you get something that's like the size of a can of tuna, mm-hmm. with a celery stalk hanging out of it and liver sauce on it, mm-hmm. that may be very avant-garde, but not many people want to either spend the time or lifetime that they have or the money eating that.
Yeah.
You know? It may impress somebody as being a very artistic expression, but
life's too short to eat food you don't like.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you're told this is fantastic food and you should eat it when it's not your cup of tea, but it's this huge restaurant guide. Who are you to naysay it? You're just, you know, somebody who likes food.
Then they treat you like you're...
something's wrong with you. You're not cultured enough to enjoy it. Yeah. And I think we're coming full circle into why we wanted to do this podcast in the first place in general. Because we wanted to talk about food that normal people would like and try to demystify some of it and make it less scary. And I don't know if we're doing a good job of making French food less scary or not, but when I was flipping through Mastering the Art of French Cooking, I'm just amazed at how many recipes in there are very approachable, how many things look really good, how many things make me go,
Were there any things in there that your mother actually made?
Crepes. Really, my family, the only French food I remember eating as a kid are crepes. My parents... Did we talk about this in an episode yet? I don't think so.
Go ahead.
I grew up, my parents were both teachers, so we didn't really do family breakfast together during the weekdays. It's just not accessible at that point. When dad's leaving to go to school at like 6:45, and, you know, the kids are all getting ready to go to school within the next hour, and mom's getting ready to go to school to teach, too. So you ate breakfast as you could. When I was a kid, mom made sure I ate a good breakfast. As I became a teenager, she let me pick what I wanted, which usually ended up being like chocolate cake or something. No, she would, you know, if I wanted something made, she'd make it. But I hit a point where I didn't need anything made. I'd make it myself, or we had freezer breakfasts or whatever. But on Saturdays, that was family breakfast time, especially when I was still young enough that my sister was living at home. And you would do a big family breakfast together after Saturday morning cartoons. And it would be, you know, your classic, I guess, I want to call it a Canadian breakfast now. You know, eggs, ham, or sausage, or bacon, and potatoes, and toast, and all this stuff. Just, you'd gorge on breakfast food and then go slip into a coma later in the day. Or waffles. Mom would do waffles. We never ate a lot of pancakes.
I've had Mom Mazur's breakfast, and it's like you want to go back to bed afterwards.
Mom Mazur's breakfast takes it out of you. But every once in a while, I don't even want to say every once in a while. I make it sound like it was twice a year. I'd say about once a month or so, my dad would break out the big cast iron skillet. Later on, he switched to a regular skillet. And my dad would make crepes. Mom would make the batter. Dad would actually do the crepe making. And when my family does crepes, we don't put fresh fruit in them. We spread preserves on them. And then you roll it up, and you sprinkle powdered sugar on it. And Mom had that cool Tupperware powdered sugar sprinkler. And it looks like a giant plastic Tupperware pepper mill. But when you turn the little crank at the top, powdered sugar comes out the bottom.
Hmm.
It's really cool, actually. It's like a sieve.
Cool.
It's like a glorified sieve for powdered sugar.
Or a really tiny food mill.
Yeah. It was all the rage, apparently, back in the 60s when she bought it, I guess, because it looked pretty old, even in the 80s. So that's the only French food I had any experience with. Since then, I have become I would usually put an expletive in here, but I won't because it's a clean podcast, the crepe master.
Yes.
Since then, Sheila, when we first got together, she'd never had them, so I made crepes for her, and then she began to demand them.
Well, they were delicious. Why wouldn't I demand them?
She became an insatiable crepe beast. Give me crepes or else. Yeah, that's kind of what happens about once every 2 months if she doesn't get crepes. So,
well, they're delicious. I love you to make them.
I've gotten pretty good at making them, and I guess I never knew it then I was making a French food. Until we saw the Alton Brown episode on crepes, I never realized they were a French food. I just knew them as those tasty, flat, thin pancakes that go great with jams and jellies. But that's another thing that's very accessible when you approach it from that end, and then you realize you can put other things in crepes besides sweet stuff.
Right, like maybe savory crepes.
And that's what Mastering the Art of French Cooking is all about. That's what the Julie Julia Project is all about. It's about this becoming more accessible. That's the whole point of Mastering the French Cooking, which you find out more through the movie, is that it was written for American cooks, not chefs, not restaurants, for ladies at home.
What do they say? The servantless American cook?
Yeah, and it's daunting. I mean, in the intro, she's talking about how to become better at cooking, and one of the things she says is, like, learn to handle hot food without gloves or something, and I went, eep!
But that's something in working in restaurants you kind of do automatically.
Yeah.
Where...
But she doesn't mean reaching into the oven and pulling out a pan with no gloves on. She means no. reaching into the boiling pasta to grab a piece of spaghetti or something.
To test to make sure yeah. it's done.
Yeah, that's what she means. But still, it kind of makes you go, eep! When you first read it. But the cool part about the book is there's diagrams in it. There's a lot of pictures to show you how to do stuff. Mm-hmm. This is Mastering the Art of French Cooking, not the Julie Julia Project book. And that's how Julie Powell was able to do this, because she admits she could cook, but not like that.
Right.
Because learning French
cooking... She was a home cook.
Yeah. And know? That's exactly who Mastering the Art of French Cooking was for. So that is so cool. It makes me want to go out and cook. Not tonight, though, because we already just ate, like, half a pound of cheese between the two of us and half a baguette, and Sheila mowed down on some olives, and there was some ham involved, but that's almost a French meal. Just a simple bread and cheese kind of deal. Fish, very yeah. prominent. So.
Because there's lots of coastline.
Mm-hmm. It's, and the sauces are key, though. That's the big thing that makes French cooking French cooking. And that's something that you have to learn to do, but they can be very simple sauces. Butter is
right.
a sauce.
Well, that's the thing is, like, there's the mother sauces mm-hmm. that you can build a foundation on, and everything is just a variation of a couple of different sauces.
Mm-hmm. So it's not so scary after all.
Right. Mm. I guess going off on a separate tangent, there was a lot of talk towards the end in the book and the movie about how Julie Powell really idolized Julia Child.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got some feedback from her, and...
The feedback was she wasn't taking it seriously enough. She wasn't being respectful. And it kind of devastated Julie Powell in the book.
I would be.
She seemed pretty heartbroken by it.
Yeah, and I guess what we can take away from that is everybody needs heroes, and if you're trying to live your life to be a good person bound by a specific code, whatever that code may be, then the idea of the hero is more important, in a way, than the actual person themselves.
Mm-hmm. And it would be the same thing as if we got an email from Alton Brown in 6 months telling us that our podcast sucked.
Why are you wasting my time?
We would be devastated. Not that we ever expect Alton Brown to hear it, but, you know, we hold him to a high standard because he's very passionate about what he does. He's very good at what he does, and he approaches cooking in a way that we both understand because of
we
the scientific
relate
nature
very well to it.
He brings into it. And it would be the same thing for it was the same thing for Julie Powell.
Yes.
Oh, my God, I've idolized this woman. She would talk to Julia Child as she was cooking. I mean, she would talk to her in her mind, and she really got into it. And knowing a little bit more about Julia Child now, I can see why. This is a woman who's very passionate.
And she had to work very hard to get where she did.
And crazy, almost insurmountable obstacles to get where she
for
did.
For a woman to be in the cordon bleu mm-hmm. during that time
yeah.
was unheard of.
Yeah.
And she was a trailblazer. And
yeah.
she worked really hard. You know, she's obviously had her own ideas of what the project was about and can't change her mind. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but I'd also like to exonerate Julia Child a little bit, because some people may come away with a negative opinion of the woman because of it, but you're talking about the clash of separate generations.
Yes.
Somebody who is literally pre-World War II. Julia Child was a secretary for the OSS in World War II. That meant she was the greatest generation, as it's so often put.
Right.
And she's looking at something that Generation X is doing. And that is... And almost...
It's an alien thought process.
You can't cross that gulf.
No, you can't.
You can't.
There's no way. They have just seen things that we haven't, and we've seen things that they haven't. And
etiquette has changed so much in the past 60, 70
yeah.
years to ask somebody like Julia Child to understand how off-the-cuff a blog is.
Yeah.
And how this is you burying your soul sometimes to the entire world. That's something you would only do in your private letters to somebody else, which,
right.
because all of her letters
Whereas,
survived, that's why we know so much about
right.
her as a person.
A blog is more like the next step up from those French revolutionary pamphlets that people would put out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, this is what I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the golden age of philosophy during the French Revolution, where people could put out whatever ideas they want when printing presses became accessible and
yeah.
you could rent time on them.
Well, and a blog also, it has replaced the personal letter. Email and blogs have replaced that, so you don't have this massive correspondence like Julia Child had, like H.P. Lovecraft had amongst all of their friends. Instead, you email 20 times a day to somebody, you text message them constantly, and if you have something really profound, you put it up on your MySpace or your Facebook, or you put it on your blog if you have one. And that's where... Two generations down the line, people are going to gather information about those that we don't realize are as influential as they are right now that are out there. That
yeah.
two generations down the line, they're going to isolate these people and say those were the ones who really formed what was going on based on this hopefully surviving media of electronic communication.
Right. I mean, I really look at blogs as the realization of Jefferson's
yes.
free press and freedom of speech.
It is freedom of speech.
Because anybody can say
form.
Anything they want. And that means, okay, well, they're... there's probably going to be a lot of crap out there, but that means that people that wouldn't have normally 20 years ago been mm-hmm. able to get their word out and their ideas out are able to do so. So yes, you have to sift through some crap to get to it,
yes.
but there's lots of really great ideas out there and people that are saying things that are worth listening to and posing ideas that are worth exploring.
Yes. And it's all out there, but that's something I don't think that...
It would be unfair of us to expect
to judge her harshly for not understanding right. that. And honestly, I don't hold it against her. I still think Julia Child was an awesome woman. Her teaching technique was fantastic. She made things very approachable. It's heresy. It's a total heresy, and this will get some people really angry if I say it, but I want to get a little WWJD thing to wear and say, it's what would Julia do? Because mm-hmm. she's just that cool. She's really moved up in my pantheon of people I looked up to, or look up to, because she was so good at what she did.
Yeah.
And I love it when somebody makes something accessible to the masses. That is my most favorite thing to see happen when it comes to unapproachable subjects. If
right.
you can make history accessible to the masses, like Stephen Ambrose, go for it.
Yeah.
If you can make cooking accessible to the masses, like Alton Brown does, like all the TV chefs do, like Julia Child pioneered, you don't get any better than that in my book. So.
Exactly.
We are so off topic of food right now.
Are we?
Yeah.
Are we really?
Yes. So, that's what we thought of the movie. Maybe we're reading way more into it than was really there. If you want to just go for a topical, fun movie, it is hilarious.
Yes.
The book is a fantastic read. On a literary note, her style reminds me a lot of a cross between Dave Barry and Irma Bombeck. It's very humorous style, very easy to get through. Mastering the Art of French Cooking, don't be afraid of it. If your mom or grandma has a copy on the shelf, grab it and flip through it. If they don't, you know, go sit in Barnes & Noble for a day and flip through it. If you don't have a Barnes & Noble or a bookstore near you, there's always the internet. You could probably find a copy to look at online. Though I advocate buying the book.
You can probably actually peruse it through Google Books.
Mm-hmm.
They give you a free look at the book, I think.
And you'll be surprised at the number of recipes there that you'll find variations for the same recipe, but the heart and soul of it is in Mastering the Art of French Cooking. The French onion soup recipe is
yeah.
the same one almost every place I found it online as what's in Mastering the Art of French Cooking, with a couple tweaks. I liked Julia Child's one the best, though, I think.
And the crepe recipe that we always use from Alton Brown is mm-hmm. pretty much almost the same, isn't it?
Almost, yeah. His is a little different. I like the fact he does his in the blender. It makes it easier to blend, and it's less of a mess, because you can just dip it with a ladle right out of the blender. Less dishes.
Yeah.
I'm all for doing
it's
less dishes.
It's more efficient.
Yes. It's not lazy, it's efficient.
Speaking of efficiency, I want a kitchen like that.
Oh my god, Julia Child's kitchen is so cool! She has pegboards, and there's little outlines of all the dishes on the pegboards, so you know which one goes back to where it is. It looks like somebody's, like, garage,
yeah.
but it's a kitchen.
It's like the German efficiency of a tool shop.
Yeah. And that's really cool, because you know where everything is, you know what you have, you don't forget that you bought this pan. I go under the cabinet, and there's times I forget I own certain things, and I don't own that much.
No, exactly. It's too easy to lose your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were watching the Julia Child program, I didn't realize that the magnets that people put their knives on went back to the 60s.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Because I first saw them in restaurants that I was working at, and I just figured that it was a modern...
innovation, yeah.
Well, okay. 1980s or 90s onward innovation.
Yeah, I never realized that either. And that's kind of cool that, you know, people were trying to use that back in the 60s.
Yeah.
So, got anything else to add on it? I'm about tapped out.
I think that's pretty much it.
I mean,
our picnic is done.
We've gone so far off track on it. But it's so hard to articulate how much we both enjoyed the movie and the book. And we really wanted to get it out there to encourage people to go see it. It's not a chick flick.
That's... the only thing that's bad about it is being advertised as a chick flick. It's a comedy with women. That does not make it a chick flick.
Mm-mm.
Anybody can enjoy this.
And the men were really, I think, the sub-protagonists, I guess, in the book, or the movie. They really focused on the husbands more in the movie, and that was nice the way they did that.
Yeah, it wasn't all about Julia. It was about the people around them, too.
Mm-hmm. So, this is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Spy Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the Spy Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.